Their sponsored radio. And coming up right now is Animal Voices.
Thinking person must oppose all cruel customs, no matter how deeply rooted in tradition, surrounded by a halo. We need a boundless ethic that will include all animals. And that's a quote from Albert Schweitzer. Welcome to Animal Voices. This show is brought to you through the cooperative efforts of three local organizations, the Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Save Canada, and Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection. Views expressed are not necessarily those of these societies. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are co-host John Pranger and technician Alan Jensen. Last weekend, as many of you know, the second annual Animal Voices Film Festival was held in Vancouver. The event included outstanding documentary films, displays by local animal welfare groups, informative, entertaining speakers, plus great music and song. Congratulations to Carl Loskin, a co-host on this program and the person responsible for starting the Animal Voices Film Festival in 2005. He did a magnificent job planning, organizing, and overseeing the event this year. Thanks are also due to the great number of people who contributed their time, talents, and money-making skills to the festival. It was a huge success. A little later in the show, we're going to be hearing from one of the presenters, Dana Lyons, a very entertaining person with a message, many messages to prevent in music and song. At the top of the hour, we'll be hearing from John Pranger. John's going to be talking on a couple of subjects today. One is meat eating, and it's effects on the environment, and the other, why animal experiments should be outlawed. In the latter part of the hour, Roger Brinker will be on the line from Fort McLeod, Alberta. He is the owner-operator of Big Julie's Rescue Ranch, a sanctuary for a wide range of needy animals. Now, John, I'd like to ask you to tell us something about meat eating, will you?
Thank you, Mark. Yes, well, we've pointed out before in the show, and here it is again. This is an opinion piece that appeared in the Vancouver Courier last week, Friday, and it's by Jeff Olson. And the big headline is, "Eating meat is worse for the environment than driving a gas guzzler." Amazing revelation. And he talks about an upcoming United Nations report which pegs the world's oil, gas, and mining industries as responsible for nearly two-thirds of all violations of human rights, environmental laws, and international labor standards. And this report also determined that the food and beverage industries are a distant second in the nastiness sweepstakes. So if you want to act globally and think locally, you should probably focus more on the dinner plate than on the gas pump. Recent research at the University of Chicago indicates that gas-guzzling motor vehicles are less a factor in energy consumption and climate change than the kind of food we eat. The researchers calculated the carbon compound connections of both a typical vegan diet and a U.S.-style carnivorous diet. And they followed the energy pathways, as they're called, from farm to processing to distribution to cooking and consumption, and the heavy detergents needed for cleanup as well. And in an article in The Guardian, the articleist explains or sums up the findings, and that is that the average burger or the human being eating a burger emits the equivalent of 1.5 tons more carbon dioxide every year than the standard vegan. That's 1.5 tons more. By comparison, were you to trade in your conventional gas guzzler for a state-of-the-art Prius hybrid, your carbon dioxide savings would amount to little more than 1 ton per year. So compare 1.5 tons on a vegan diet and 1 ton by using alternate fuel. So the conclusion is that each of us could make a bigger contribution to reducing emissions of greenhouse gases by becoming vegan than by converting to an eco-friendly car. And, of course, the highest energy consumption factor in food production involves meat. The amount of gas and oil involved in the food production of meat exceeds that of other foodstuffs. So the data on the economic benefits of a vegan diet versus hybrid cars. And, of course, meat-free diets promote better health. And this means that mass aversion towards diets could and would translate into huge savings to our maxed-out healthcare system. Now, many people don't think that the vegan route is very joyful and is really filled with self-denial. There's still the vegetarian route, which includes eggs and dairy, of course. Mm-hmm. So we're all linked together by the energy relations of carbon cycles, and not just to one another, but to all living beings we share the biosphere with. And this doesn't even talk about the mistreatment of food animals in our day and age. And that, of course, casts a tremendous shadow over the whole business also.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about in that, isn't there?
No kidding. Now, isn't that amazing that we can, mm-hmm. by a small change like that, affect such a tremendous difference?
Right.
So we're really all responsible. And these half measures of turning off the tap between brushing the brushes of the teeth are really pathetic when it comes to
saving the environment.
When it comes to the effects that each of these things will have. But veganism and going vegetarian is rarely touched, is it?
I think, in that article, you mentioned something about not necessarily hopping into veganism right off the bat, but going through a vegetarian conversion where you still have your milk, which a lot of people think is absolutely necessary to mm-hmm. life, mm-hmm. and eggs. Now, and we know the way to go if you're making that step rather than taking a leap. Remember that buy certified organic,
yes.
whether you're buying eggs or milk. Certified organic is what to get.
Not only for welfare, but also for ecological reasons. Once again.
Absolutely.
The input puts are very small compared to intensive factory farming methods, and the health of the chickens and your health is going to
ultimately your own health.
Save health or save lives and money.
Yeah.
So the economic argument is there. So why not call on the governments of the world to sponsor organic farming rather than the opposite?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's been ways of discouraging organic farmers. Well, there's a big scare about
Absolutely.
The avian flu is one where the organic farmer was harder hit than the other, than the factory farms.
Yes.
To the detriment of the human health, I think.
Well, and what are the governments of the world now doing? They're stockpiling antivirals and they're stockpiling vaccines to be used on people. Isn't it much better to clean up the problem at its source, to shut down these factory farm operations, because they're the ones that are breeding these diseases? They're not being bred by migratory birds. That is complete and utter nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
They are being the birds that are confined experience the same plagues that human societies used to in the Middle Ages experience because of filthy conditions and of an ignorance of hygiene and standards of living. which escaped the notice of these people, of people in those times. And it wasn't until the revival of these concepts in modern medicine that human health began to improve and these epidemics disappeared. And now we're creating epidemics in the animal world. And to protect ourselves, rather than preventing the problem, that we come up with solutions to manage it. Well, this is like the healthcare system, which is just something that people like to manage. They don't like to cure disease, because curing disease would put them out of business, and their business is sick people.
Right. Yeah, and that's where the profit lies.
And what do they do? Well, they have this system of research which is based on this massive cruelty to animals, where animals are tortured to death by the billions. Such as, and in ludicrous experiments, such as maternal deprivation experiments on monkeys. And these have been going on since the 50s, since Harry Harlow came up with his maternal deprivation experiments on primates. And he took newborn monkeys away from their mothers at the National Primate Research Center and isolated them with surrogate mothers made of cloth or wire. And he actually claimed to be studying the nature of love. And he spent a lot of the taxpayers' money. Well, now there's another gentleman who's taken up the slack since Harry left the planet, and his name is Davis. And Harry's research ought to have disappeared with him in the grave, and should have entered the history's hall of shame. Researchers for decades have continued on with similar experience over and over again. So there's this character at Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta by the name of Michael Davis, has been given more than $5 million by the National Institutes of Health in the past decade. So that's $500,000 a year of the taxpayers' money to study fear and anxiety in animals, which he produces. That is to say, he produces the fear and the anxiety. Clever man. And he removes infant monkeys from their mothers in a futile attempt to examine the effects of child abuse and neglect, as if we don't have enough clinical experience with these things, and hundreds of thousands, perhaps, of neglected and abused children from whom we can get better studies and accurate studies, and then devise ways of tackling the problem. But to then reproduce these anxieties and fears in another species is just the height of ignorance and stupidity. And in one test, he straps the monkeys into a full body restraint chair inside a wooden box, and then startles them with noise at a level up to 120 decibels, which is similar to that of a jackhammer or an airplane engine. He does this from speakers that are just a few inches from the monkey's ears. Then he measures how much they struggle and how fast their hearts beat, and somehow or other he thinks that he's doing us a favor, and that from this data we can extrapolate and then prevent or manage the human situation. So dozens of these studies dating back to Harlow's time have been shown that even short-term separations from their mother's love and protection is terrifying for baby monkeys. And in Davis's laboratory at Yerkes, experimenters devised a study in which they separated infants from their mothers, and then, surprise, surprise, found that these babies cried much more than did the babies who were allowed to stay with their mothers. And for that, you had to pay $500,000.
Pathetic, isn't it? And we encourage that, and these institutions encourage it to go on with the same repetitive, often, studies, and so costly. But there's profit in that.
And these gentlemen on high that approve these studies and dole out the money are politicians and our bureaucrats. I lost my train of thought there, but... They have criminal ideas in their minds, which filters down to the rest of society. And I don't doubt for one moment that these are responsible for much of the violence that seems to be innate in the social contract these days, because many scientists have voiced the notion that the higher morality is that might makes right and that the end justifies the means. That is how they justify their experiments. The end justifies the means because we're going to save human beings this means.
As we both know so well, John, they are misleading findings if you try to apply them to the human.
Absolutely. And the monkey is, of course, so stressed out that no result could possibly be of any use. As a matter of fact, the warning has been given out in the medical journals that none of the major carcinogens, those that cause cancer in human beings, cause cancer in chimps, our closest relatives. Not a single one of those carcinogens will cause cancer in a chimpanzee. Now, go figure.
Yeah.
So why should we study monkeys for cancer, for cancerogenicity?
And we do it over and over and over again.
Yes, and then what do we get? We get cancer-causing drugs on the market because we've missed on the monkeys. The monkeys don't get the same reaction as we do, and lo and behold, but the profit is out there. Five, you know, like Vioxx, which is really animal experimentation. It's supposed to provide us with safe products, chemicals, drugs, right, and procedures. And yet it does exactly the opposite. It provides us with unsafe procedures, unsafe drugs, unsafe chemicals.
We have proven that many times, haven't we?
Many times, thousands of times, ad nauseam. I mean, how many people have suffered and died? How many people have been crippled, blinded, burned? Their internal organs have to be removed. Or children such as the thalidomide babies. And yet Kemi Grunenthal, the manufacturer of this drug, this deadly drug, which they put out under 100 different names to disguise the their guilt, they're still in business, you know.
Yeah.
None of those people ever are charged with what they should be charged with, namely assault, causing bodily harm, or even murder, because the people at Vioxx knew very well, the people that were producing Vioxx knew from their studies that it was causing heart attacks in people and heart failure.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is one of the biggest that contributors to political campaigns, so I suppose that is part of the answer to why it continues happening.
And the FDA is our gatekeeper and is supposed to regulate the industry, but in fact it regulates the public and keeps the public at bay. And here's what Dr. Herbert Ley, former FDA commissioner, said to the San Francisco Chronicle in 1970. He said, "People think the FDA is protecting them. It isn't. What the FDA is doing and what the public thinks it's doing are as different as night and day. First, it's providing a means whereby key individuals on its payroll are able to obtain both power and wealth through granting special favors to certain politically influential groups, namely the drug companies, that are subject to its regulation. Well, this activity is similar to the protection racket of organized crime. For a price, one can induce FDA administrators to provide protection from the FDA itself."
Shocking.
It's a racket.
Yeah.
Secondly, as a result of this political favoritism, the FDA has become a primary factor in that formula whereby cartel-oriented companies in the food and drug industry are able to use the police powers of government to harass or destroy their free market competitors. And thirdly, the FDA occasionally does some genuine public good with whatever energies it has left over after serving the vested political and commercial interest of its first two activities, namely the protection of the profits of the deadly pharmaceutical chemical trust.
Thank you for that, John.
All right.
You've made your point very well. Now, as a little diversion from hearing about the horrors of research on animals, I have something rather more uplifting, and it's called Warning from the Dolphins. And this is a story, a short story by a woman who experienced swimming with the dolphins, and I'll tell you what happened to her. "In the late 1980, I found that I had become very attracted to dolphins. I read books about dolphins and their amazing abilities. Dolphins were said to have healing and telepathic abilities and a knack for opening people's hearts. I wanted to experience firsthand some of the wonders everyone wrote about. Since I only wanted to support free dolphins, I voted with my dollars and refused the easy contacts with dolphins in captivity, not going to the local aquarium, in other words. I finally found dolphins in the wild in the lush waters of Hawaii. One sunny Hawaiian day, I was swimming with two friends in a group of about 70 spinner dolphins. We forgot everything but our joy in the moment. I felt like I could swim forever with our newfound angels, and it did feel angelic. It was as though I had been lifted into heaven on earth. If there are spiritual masters on this earth, these dolphins are among them. They showed me how to feel oneness, and they took me into an envelope of safety that helped me swim and overcome my fear of deep water. Suddenly, in the midst of our ecstasy, my friends and I each heard a loud, clear message, "Get out of the water now." We lifted our heads from under the water and confirmed that we had all heard the same thing. It was as if the words had been spoken out loud. Hearing the message simultaneously dazzled us. It meant that telepathy between dolphins and humans was real, not just the wishful thinking of a joyful soul. In addition, I heard the dolphins communicate to me, "You have just enough energy to make it back to shore." I was feeling fine, and I didn't have any reason for the warning. But finally, I listened to the dolphins, because halfway to the beach, my legs started to cramp. I barely arrived at the shore. As I tried to stand up, I collapsed back into the waves. The waves were small that day, otherwise I could not have been able to crawl out of the water to shore. Obviously, my angel dolphins had assessed my body's ability, which I had totally forgotten in my ecstatic swim with them. I was oblivious to my limits, but they kept an eye on me. Had the dolphins been able to measure my strength? How had they transmitted the message? If I had been the only one to hear the dolphins' warning, I would have considered it an act of my own intuition. But there we were, three intelligent adults, all of whom had heard the same message to get out of the water now. Dolphins have saved many lives in the ocean. That day, when I swam with my friends and the dolphins, I understood why the ancient Greeks called them angels of the sea.
What a beautiful story.
Isn't that lovely? And think of what we do with dolphins. It's so sad, isn't it?
I just wanted to throw in something here, too, because, you know, in the last week, one of the dolphins in the Stanley Park Aquarium was supposed to give birth, but the baby dolphin died before the dolphin was able to get in birth. And people in the aquarium were talking about how surprised they were, you know. And here they have this dolphin that had been locked up for a long time in this small little holding pool while it was pregnant, and in this environment that is just totally foreign to an animal like a dolphin, and they're surprised when the animals don't react normally and act normally and so on, and they've had numerous attempts in that aquarium to have dolphins give birth, and every one of them has failed. Every one, right? And then same with the whales. They've had no success with their whales also giving birth, and it just shows something. And yet, you must know also that last week, the Vancouver Park Board decided to change the law. There was a bylaw in Vancouver that would say if they wanted to expand the aquarium, they'd have to go to the people and have a plebiscite. And the Park Board changed that bylaw, so now the park or the aquarium can just go ahead and expand by another 30% their size, because they want to make bigger pools for these mammals. That's what they want the more space for, which is just so amazing that in this day and age, with all the information that's coming out about this, that this can still be going on, and that our park board would agree to take space out of Stanley Park, which means cutting trees down in Stanley Park, so they can have these bigger pools, so they can torture these sea mammals. Hey?
Oh, it's atrocious. I know a lot of people in Vancouver were fighting that at the meeting last Monday evening. They were out there in goodly number working against it, but without success. Mm-hmm. It seems so often the obvious positive action is rejected for something totally negative.
Yeah, and John Nightingale and his staff were aghast at the comments made by no whales in captivity, and then they said mother and child both would have died in the wild. Well, how do they know that? And as if that's an excuse.
Oh,
and so they've saved lives, according to them.
Saved lives.
Yeah.
Shortened lives.
And they've saved the mother's lives, and the other is a tragedy, an act of God that has nothing to do with them.
I see.
Yeah.
You can rationalize anything, I guess. Huh?
I suppose.
Yeah. Now, Alan, I'd like to get a little bit of music on the show. We have that wonderful gentleman, Dana Lyons, with Ride the Lawn.
My grandpa was a cowboy, and his pa before him. They rode the range, killed the buffalo, and fought the Indian. But the great herd's on the prairie, and the wild frontier is gone. So to carry on my heritage, I go out and ride the lawn. Ride the lawn, ride the lawn. Here on my quarter-acre lot, I sing my freedom song. Ride the lawn, ride the lawn. We'll hunt the dandelion down and whack him till he's gone. My neighbor is a slacker, and he rarely rides the lawn. He says that he likes wildflowers with dew on them at dawn. But the enemy travels quickly when the winds are strong. Next week while he's on vacation, his dandies will be gone. Ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn.
Here on my quarter acre lot, I sing my freedom song. Ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn, ha. We'll hunt the dandelion down and whack him till he's gone.
Ride the lawn.
The problem with suburbia is you cannot shoot your gun. So how does one kill herds of moles who eat grass just for fun? Well, I've loaded up my arsenal with shells and ammo cans, and under cover of the fireworks, July 4th, I'll make my stand.
Ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn.
Here on my quarter acre lot, I sing my freedom song. Ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn. We'll hunt the dandelion down and whack him till he's gone.
Ride the lawn.
My son came home from college, and he criticized my lawn. He said fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides are wrong. Well, I'll listen to your politics and your weirdo leftist songs, but when you're under my roof, don't you dare speak ill of lawns.
Ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn.
Here on my quarter acre lot, I sing my freedom song. Ride the lawn,
ride the lawn,
ride the lawn. We'll hunt the dandelion down and whack him till he's gone.
Ride the lawn.
You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. We now have Roger Brinker on the line from Fort McLeod, Alberta, and he is the owner-operator of Big Julie's Rescue Ranch. Welcome to Animal Voices, Roger.
Good afternoon.
Nice to have you back on the show. Wonderful to hear your voice again. Now, to give our listeners a picture of the ranch, maybe you could start by giving a brief description of the property and where it's located.
Sure. We're located about 10 miles west of Fort McLeod, and the ranch consists of 174 acres, and there are hillsides and a couple of creeks and stretches of bush, and all the rest is good grass.
Ah, sounds very beautiful. And this is southwestern Alberta, isn't it, we're talking about?
Yes, it is. Fort McLeod is about 100 miles south of Calgary.
Oh, yes, so you don't get the terrible...
Way down south.
Uh-huh. Your weather is a little milder in the winter, I guess, than...
It really is, yes. Yeah. Even milder than Calgary's, yeah.
Oh, that's important to the animals, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Now, I understand you have about 100 animals on the ranch, and various species, I guess, many of them. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that.
I sort of idly counted them up in my head the other day, and to my astonishment, arrived at a number around 100. There are 44 cattle. There are 24 horses. Well, they're not all horses. They're equines. There are 20 horses, 2 donkeys, and 2 mules.
And what about the dogs?
Then there are 23 dogs. And about a year and a half ago, 2 cats broke in. And they we didn't bring them in. They simply appeared. In fact, one of them I have only seen in a year and a half twice. She's called Barn Cat. Oh. The first thing I knew about her is when I, in the dust of a car sitting in the barn, here were little paw prints of a cat. Mm-hmm. And both cats have since, at some time or another, and we have no idea where and when, met up with a tomcat, so they have litters of their own.
My goodness, how are you going to control that?
Well, the one who came into the house... we had neutered as soon as she had weaned her litter. The other one, that's the barn cat, is going to be a problem, because what we'll need to do, we'll have to set out a live trap and take her to the vet to have her spayed. You know, because
I know you are reluctant to have surgery on your animals generally, aren't you?
Well, not when it comes to spaying and to spaying, because. I simply can't have an uncontrolled growth of animals, you know.
Oh, I'm sure, yes. So how do most of those animals get to your property? I know you get the odd one who just wanders in, such as the cats, but how do the larger animals, for example?
I even have some cows wander in.
Oh.
last year, a friend was helping out here, said, there's a new calf in the pasture. And I went out to see what was going on, and even from a distance, I knew that this was not a calf born here, because both the cow and the calf had ear tags, and I don't do anything to my animals. They are not ear tagged, they are not branded, they're not dehorned, because all those things are more or less painful to the animals, and I just don't do that. So this was obviously a cow who had come through a fence. And I checked the fence to see if it was down, if there was any great big hole there, and there wasn't. So she and her calf had to have made an effort to squeeze through the fence, and she was quite happily settled down with 3 or 4 old cows who formed a little social group of their own.
Really?
And eventually, now, the little calf was a steer calf, and... Deer calves are kept for only one reason, to be fattened and slaughtered. So if I sent him back, if I had sent the cow and the steer back to the original owner, he would have another year to live at most, and then he'd die. Mm. And, of course, I don't want to do that. So when this happens, and it's she was not the first cow who broke in. I think she must be the fourth or fifth. Whenever that happens, I contact the owner and say, look, she's already here, and sooner or later you're going to sell her anyway. Why don't you sell her to me? You know.
Mm.
And that's what I did in this instance. And
so you bought both the animals then?
I bought both the animals, unfortunately, at an outrageous price.
Oh.
Because he knows that I don't want to see this little guy die. You know, he knows that he can overcharge me, and I will not back off, because I want to save these two animals.
Mm. Oh, really,
In this instance, I got the last laugh, because earlier this year, my helper and I were feeding the animals, and we drive along the row as they feed, as they eat the hay. And my helper, James, got quite excited and said, "Oh, look at that. Here's the cow." And this was the mother of the cow-calf combination. Mm-hmm. She had a huge bag on her ab. Her udder was grotesquely swollen.
Really?
And he said, "There's something wrong with this. She's, you know, there must be an infection in there, because she shouldn't be that big. Even though she's nursing a calf, she wasn't that big before." And I took one look at it, and I said, "You know, James, I think she's having another calf."
My goodness.
And I think she's going to have another calf soon. Soon, in this instance, turned out to be an hour and a half.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? And that's astonishing, isn't it? And nobody had been aware of it till that moment.
No, I'm sure that if the man had realized that she not only had a calf by her side, but also carried another one, he would
have charged you up. Oh, my goodness.
So they are,
I know you always love to have animals, more and more of them, don't you? And so this was a delight to you, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
You can't resist these animals.
They're called refugee, immigrant, and the last one is little brother.
Oh, yeah. Well, the mother maybe was saving her child when she wandered into your place.
Well, I don't know how cows think, but obviously, and in each instance, the animal that did come in came from the herd of this particular man. And obviously, there must be something in the demeanor of the animals that live here, how calm they are, or I don't know how content they are, that strikes the animal on the other side of the fence as desirable.
Must be.
Where they come to the conclusion, "I'd rather live there."
Sure.
How far away was that? Did he come?
Oh, she just came through the fence.
Oh, so so the farm is right next to yours?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. He's got hundreds and hundreds of cows.
Oh, yeah.
And he has, in fact, one of his properties is at the south side of my ranch. Another pastor of his is on the north side, and in this instance, he had come through the fence on the north side and just wandered down the hill and was living next to the creek.
Hmm. Now I know you have a couple of giants in the ranch, and I'm sure the audience would be interested to hear about these two giants. Can you tell us the story?
Giants. Around last Christmas time, I got a phone call from BC. A man said he lived on a commune or a little religious community which for some reason or another had dissolved. And they were left with, I think he said, 9 cows and 2 horses. And he had heard about me and would I take the animals. And I said, "Well, you're a long way away. Possibly, you know, it would be easier for you to find someone closer than that. But if you don't find a room for these animals, I will take them." And so some weeks went by. And then there was another phone call. Can we bring 2 cows and 2 horses next week? And I said, "Trevor," I said, "you could. So come on up." And he hadn't said anything what they were, whether they were milk cows, what size horses they were. So the trailer drives up, and out wander 2 huge black horses. And I've always liked, never had any of those really heavy draft horses. And the first phrase that came to my mind when those two huge horses walked off the trailer, "Here be giants." So they are named Peter and Paul, and they're just all black, except Paul has a small white star on his forehead, and they're just the nicest, calmest.
Really? Now, I noticed that I read in your newsletter that Tom Mix, the mule, was rather startled by them. Will you tell us that story?
Oh, Tom Mix, male, mules do not need to be neutered. they are sterile. While they have the equipment, it doesn't function. It doesn't work. They cannot produce little folds all over the place. So Tom Mix kept his equipment, and I suppose it makes him think that he's the boss. He's not. There are all kinds of horses bigger than he, but he really thinks he's the cat's meow. So quite often he will be trotting around with the pasture, and all the horses are following docile fashion behind him. When I get new animals into the place, I put them into an enclosure where they can meet the other animals over a fence, rather than, you know, here we are at each other's throat, just to see how they get along. And the two giants, for one thing, my fences are high enough that horses have to sort of stretch their necks to look over. The giants are so big, they would march up to the fence and look down over the fence. So here was Tom Mix coming trotting along around various corners and solid fences, and came face to face with the giant. And he ground to a halt and shrieked. Mules sort of have a very strange call. It's not the braying of a donkey. It's not the whinny of a horse. It's sort of a shriek that stops in mid-shriek. So Tom Mix came in there, looked at the two giants, and shrieked. The giant stood absolutely unmoved and unimpressed. So Tom Mix took a couple of steps back, reared up on his hind legs, his front hooves started thrashing the air, and shrieked again. The giant stood in absolute immobility, utterly unimpressed. And Tom Mix just gave him one more look and tore off with all the horses falling behind him.
Oh, really? So he was leading the crowd.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I could imagine that shriek is pretty difficult to bear, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, you have 23 dogs now, and they have a separate yard, don't they? A huge yard.
For much of the year, they can run on the entire property. Right now, they're in the inner yard. I have my inner yard. Uh-huh. Has 8-foot-high fences around it. And the reason I have them in the inner yard, lots of people think, when they think of a yard, they think of a little manicured lawn in front of the house.
Mm.
My inner yard is about 5 or 6 acres.
5 or 6 acres, I see. Yeah.
So it's huge. And the reason they're inside that yard at this time is because I have a collection of pups who are only, they're not really pups anymore. They're now a year and a half old. But they're very rambunctious. And all over the place in cattle country, there are now cows with calves.
Oh, I see.
And I don't want them, if they run at my herd, first of all, there aren't any calves. Usually, you know, the little brother was an exception. And my cows and horses, if they really get barked at by a couple of dogs, they just look at them and say, you know.
Especially the giants.
I know these guys. You know, they're just a lot of bark. No, nothing to worry about.
I see.
While somebody else's herd, they might stampede the entire herd.
Oh,
so
yeah.
While all these cattle are around in the pastures around me, the dogs are in the inner yard.
Ah, yeah, I see. And they all get along well together, I suppose, do they?
Yeah. Mm. They run free in the yard. There are no cages or pens or anything like that. None of them wear any collars.
Now, you used to have the hooligans. I believe they were in and out of the house frequently, weren't they?
The hooligans are still around.
They are.
They're still around. Oh yeah, they're getting on in years now. They're now 6 or 7 years old. So they're settled down a bit. But the latest lot, a year and a half, they're still, I suppose, they're sort of teenagers, you know.
Are they certain number of dogs that you consider house dogs?
There are some. My back door during the summer, my back door is open, and they can walk in and out as they please. And some dogs choose never to come into the house, while others will come in for the night or run in and out during the daytime.
Oh,
and,
I see.
I think there are about, let me think, there are 17 who usually spend the night in the house.
17? Oh. Oh, goodness. What a menagerie. sounds wonderful. Now, I know that when an animal gets to your ranch, he becomes a permanent resident practically always. And I suppose once in a blue moon, it doesn't work out that way, that he maybe goes to some other place. But usually it's for the rest of his natural life that he stays there.
That's the primary rule. No matter how you got here, whether you were born here or bought or dropped off, if you want to stay here, you are here for life.
Yeah. Often you go to auctions, or sometimes you go to auctions, I guess, and buy animals, don't you?
Yeah. Tom Mix, for example, Tom Mix is born here, and I happened to go to an auction, and here his mother was for sale, already carrying Tom Mix, and the only man bidding for her was the horse butcher.
Oh my!
And I just, that just rubs me the wrong way. Here's a pregnant mare is going to be slaughtered.
Yeah, yes. So too much to.
I knew she was carrying a mule because the man who owned her raises mules commercially.
So was that the first mule you got?
Yeah, that was the first one.
Oh yeah.
And then I got a second one, and in a roundabout way, a neighbor had two donkeys which she couldn't keep, and I knew. She said, "Well," she just phoned one day and said, "Would you like a couple of donkeys?" And I said, "Sure, I'll take a couple of donkeys." And I knew that they weren't fixed.
Oh yeah.
But I looked at the little donkeys. You know, donkeys are a whole lot smaller than horses.
Oh yes.
I looked at my big mares and the little donkeys. And I thought, nah, nothing going to happen. I don't have to worry here. Turns out love will find a way.
I see.
So the following spring, my helper said, there's a little mule in the pasture.
Oh, lovely little mule.
Yeah. And
irresistible.
He is the nicest little thing. She's probably the friendliest of the equines that I have.
Lovely. Now, I know that you have another story that you can tell us about a horse that is going to be coming out to Victoria.
Oh.
Now, this is an exception to the permanent home business, isn't
nothing.
It? Can you tell us that story?
Sweet Nothing, sure. Sweet Nothing one morning had a slightly swollen foot and a very tiny wound in the back of the leg, no more than an inch and a half long. I couldn't figure out how she had done that, and it was because the hoof was slightly swollen, the ankle was slightly swollen. I thought, oh, this is just an infection from this little cut, and we brought the vet in. We treated her for infection, and it didn't get better, and it didn't get better, and eventually I took her to another vet and had her X-rayed, and it turned out one of the smaller bones in her foot was broken. Not any, great break where she couldn't put her foot down. She walked on it, but she walked on it with a limb because it was swollen. And we then tried operations, but by that time arthritis had set in, and it was only partially successful, and the leg became worse and worse and worse, and stiffened up, the joint no longer moved, and another horse specialist thought he could cure that. He could operate on that, and I think she was there for I think 6 months in that horse hospital, and had three more operations. And eventually she came home, and while the leg had healed up, a previous incision broke open again, and it never healed again. It got worse and worse and worse. And since I had really by this time tried everything, all I could think of, and she got around on three legs, and just simply kept that injured leg off the ground. And I thought, well, there's nothing more I can do. I'll just have to. And if she wants to get around on three legs and happy and run around with the other horses hobbling around, well, fine. And then I heard, some friends of mine heard about a man in Florida who specializes in making artificial limbs for all kinds of animals. And he had made artificial limbs for horses. And they said, well, why don't we have that leg amputated and have it and fit him with an artificial leg, because, you know, she'll be better that way. She'll get around better that way. And they, in fact, offered to pay for all the cost involved with the amputation and the artificial leg. And that's what they did. And the horse is now at the stage. I just talked to them yesterday. She now has her artificial limb fitted. But since my friends who had, at the time they lived in Calgary, that's how they got to know me. That's how they got to know Sweet Nothing. Lovely little horse. But they have since moved to Victoria. And since they have taken such great care and have spent so much money on her, and they love her dearly, I said, look, she of course has a spot here. She can always be here. But would you be happier having her there? You know, you have spent so much money on her. I'll let her live with you. And they were just thrilled at the thought of having the horse. So in about 2 weeks, I will take her out to the island, and she will live on an acreage near Victoria.
Wonderful! What a story! Gosh, there's no end of the care you put into those animals, Roger. We have to admire what you do.
That's what we do, you know.
Yes, you dedicate your life to the animals. I know.
I've sort of committed myself to that, and.
And it's been a long, long time, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
How many years?
Well, I started saving dogs in 1970.
1970.
So that's 36 years. And then when I bought this ranch, I could keep. Until then, I'd only had dogs and
quite a few
long periods of time. But when I moved here, I realized that I could keep cattle and horses, and so that started in '89. So that would be 17.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Well, goodness, it's been a long time. Now, we're running out of time, unfortunately, Roger. But one last question. Assistance on the ranch. How are you doing for assistance these days? I know sometimes you're on your own, and that must be terribly difficult.
In fact, this is the first time I've had help in the winter. Until then, I would find someone who came with great fanfare and promise they'd love to be here, and this is where they want to live. And then when winter came, suddenly they thought it would be nicer in the city.
Oh, I see.
So this year is the first time when I've had somebody stay through the winter.
Oh, that must have been a blessing.
Oh, I'm wrong. Oh, it's the second time. But the first one, simply once he was here, decided, he wanted to live here, all right. But... He did very little or no work.
Oh, so...
It simply became a computer. His wife had bought a computer, I suppose. Mm. And he would kept proudly telling me what all new things he's learning on the computer. But the place fell apart around him, and he never lifted a hand.
Yeah.
But the last one, this year's man, I think, wants to stay here. And he's worked very hard.
Wonderful.
And done a lot of things, and has great experience.
Oh, that's
in handling,
wonderful!
Handling cows and horses,
and he's got the energy to do it.
He's on a disability pension, but he's doing fine with it.
Good, that's wonderful. So I must now thank you very much for being with us today, Roger. It's always a pleasure to hear from you.
Oh, I so much enjoy talking to you.
Thank you, and I really enjoy your newsletter.
Okay. You'll get the next one.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Roger Brinker, who is the owner-operator of Big Julie's Rescue Ranch in Fort McLeod, Alberta. If anybody's interested in maybe dropping a line to Roger, encouraging him and his wonderful work, it's Big Julie's Rescue Ranch, Box 145, Fort McLeod, Alberta, box 145, and the postal code is T0L0Z0. He's a wonderful man. He's been on our show before, and it's always so impressive.
You have to believe in angels when you
listen. Oh, you do, don't you? The dolphins and Roger. Now, we're going to go back to our Dana Lyons briefly, Dancing in the Dirt. He's going to sing to us this time.
I can hear your voice across the whole damn nation calling out, I'm home. So now I think it's time we start the celebration. Circuits will be blown, and we'll be dancing until sunrise. Guitars and fiddles will be jamming all night long, with all our friends and family gathered around the campfire, back in the hills amongst the trees where we belong. I can feel the moment when I see you running, to me. Open in my arms, I'm gonna let you come in. Come on home to me. And we'll be dancing until sunrise. Guitars and fiddles will be jamming all night long, with all our friends and family gathered around the campfire, back in the hills amongst the trees where we belong. Take it!
And this is Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And it is wrong, and it's bad science to take infant monkeys from their mothers. And if you want to do something about it, you can go to the PETA website, PETA.org, I believe it is, and see what you can do about it. And that is why vivisection ought to be made illegal, because it misleads doctors and sends us on a totally wrong direction in healthcare. And in his lectures around the world, Dr. Harry Lilly of England, distinguished both as physician and surgeon, makes the point that the trade of poisoning living things and the manufacture of disease is big business today. And he said, I can say emphatically, we're not going to find the cure for the diseases of our wrong living by the imposition of suffering on other living things. I know of no long-term benefit, and I stress the words long-term, that has come to the human race in the past by any research that has involved such suffering to other creatures.
Thank you, John, and thank you to the listeners for being with us on Animal Voices today. Will you please tune in?